Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will the recession do to our shop-till-you-drop culture? While plenty of anti-consumerists have welcomed the dip in retail activity since the economy went south, my guest this hour has no reason to believe all this belt-tightening will outlast the downturn, in part because of the complex relationship in our society between want, need, and purchase. Lee Eisenberg is former editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine and a former executive vice president for Land's End. He explores the reasons for our love of retail and how sellers try to shape and profit from it in his new book, Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. Lee, welcome to Think.
Good to be here, Chris.
Does shopping make us happy?
It can. It can also make us very miserable. And I take issue a little bit with the characterization of the book. I don't think we're going to bounce back to the way we were, at least not anytime soon, nor am I advocating that. But when I started the book, researching the book, we were living in the fat and happy years of 2006 or so. And then when the economy began to melt down, I said to myself, oh, my God, who wants to read about this? And then as we got closer to publication, which was just a couple of weeks ago, there were these so-called green shoots sprouting up on Main Street, and people started getting hopeful again. So, I've been on a roller coaster, but the really nice thing is that I at least got to report the book, research the book, both in reckless times and now in very cloudy times. And I do think, though, that the net effect on the mind of the consumer has changed, and I do think it's likely to continue to be different from what we used to know for quite a while.
One thing I thought that was really interesting is that you discovered research that found that we may, in fact, be pre-wired toward a particular disposition toward shopping. There are tightwads and there are spendthrifts, and not everybody is at those extremes. But will you tell us about the difference between the two?
Well, yeah. Like every other aspect of consumerism, why we buy and why we shop and what we're looking for and so on has been studied very extensively all across every department of almost every college campus, which is in and of itself different from the way it used to be. About 30 years ago, consumption was sort of sniffed at on campus. It was basically housewives squeezing melons, and they were beneath anybody's time or attention when it came to research. But then, over the last three decades, virtually every department now, marketing certainly, communications certainly, neurobiology, economics, every one of them, sociology, psychology, social psychology, everybody's running all of these studies. And when I first started the research, I saw a headline in the paper that said that a new study, which was actually a study done by a hybrid team of neuroscientists and social psychologists, had found that there may, in fact, be some kind of neurological basis for why some people are spendthrifts and some people are cheapskates. Now, I hasten to say that almost every several months we read in the paper, scientists close to finding the buy button in the brain. Last year, there was a best-selling book called Biology that more or less asserted that, and that's simply not true. There's a lot of fMRI scanning going on. The people in white coats roll a lot of subjects like us into these fancy imaging machines and then subject us to Super Bowl commercials and see what parts of our brain may be lighting up at what kinds of commercials. But the fact is, that team that I referred to earlier did see some correlation between people who profess to be skinflits and spendthrifts. And what was interesting to me was not so much the brain stuff, which is pretty tentative still, but the fact several other findings, which is that if you're a cheapskate or if you're a spendthrift, you tend not to like to be that way. You're not very happy with yourself. So what they often do is a spendthrift will marry a cheapskate, or a cheapskate will marry a spendthrift, which, of course, is not a really good idea, because then they embark on however many years of the marriage lasts, fighting and bickering over spending habits.
Well, it's interesting that you point that out because there are statistics to say that the majority of marriages that break up, the biggest disagreements are around money.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. The book I wrote before this was a book called The Number, and it was about why we have such a very difficult time dealing with money and financial planning and saving for the future and so on. It's almost the flip side of this. And in the course of that research, I talked to just dozens and dozens of financial planners, and they almost all had the same story, which is a couple would come to them and, you know, to talk about retirement planning, and invariably the next day the husband would call or the wife would call and say something like, well, I didn't really want to talk about this in front of my spouse, but, or, you know, there really is a little more money stashed away there, but nobody really knows about that. So I think these are twin issues that often either haunt us or we don't like to deal with, and they're related, obviously. You know, why we aren't doing a better job saving money and why we may not be doing a great job or a harmonious job spending money.
You divide these transactions into the buy side and the sell side. Consumers are on the buy side. Retailers and service providers are on the sell side. How well do we really understand one another?
Well, the sell side, which is this enormous universe of, you know, retailers and marketers and ad agencies and those neuroscientists who slide us into the scanning machines and these companies that track our movements online and all the hidden cameras and everything else, they pretty much I don't know if they understand us, but they certainly have us in their sights, and we're under a lot of scrutiny. Having said that, I don't really subscribe to what you hear often from anti-consumerists, that we are somehow sheep being led to our slaughter by these diabolical forces. I am not a rabid pro-consumerist at all, but I think an extreme anti-consumerist view usually doesn't give us enough credit for judgment. Now, I'm not suggesting that we need a bigger credit balance, because we obviously don't know what to do with ourselves when we have that on our credit cards. But I think we've been living in a society that has been so overwhelmingly saturated by advertising and marketing for so long that I'm not sure it really has all that much effect on us. It's like the air we breathe. We just sort of accept it. I think we can see through most of it. I don't think we're injectable with some sort of buy virus and all that. But I thought it was important that general readers be taken on a tour through the sell side to understand, you know, how it works today and also how it evolved. A fair portion of the book is really looking back in time to try to trace how we got to where we are today, you know, certainly over the last 50 years, but even over the last 100 years. On the buy side, and, you know, that's, as you said, that's our side, that's the customer side. I don't think we are very mindful about why we make the decisions we do in a store. Now, we may be more mindful today because we have to be financially and economically, but I think we make a lot of decisions that are not particularly rational ones, nor decisions that we give a whole lot of, you know, cognitive thought to.
You know, it's really interesting because it seems like there's a lot of paranoia about marketing and about the ads that are fed to us, and yet people don't, as you say, give a lot of thought to walking in a grocery store, why this is located here and that's over there.
Yeah, well, that's true, and there's an immense art and science to how a retailer goes about its business in trying to get us, one, to notice something, and two, to do what he can to seduce us into buying it. And we could talk for hours and hours and hours about what some of those, you know, tricks are. Again, I don't think one needs to be paranoid about them. I think when you just stop to think for a moment about them, you know, nobody's really fooling us. In the trade, in retail, there's a trade term called atmospherics, you know, which refers to all manner of conditions that may exist in a store that we take in through our senses. You know, there's lighting, there's color, there's how things are arranged on a shelf, there's music playing, there are some stores that pump, you know, aromas into the air, there's the demeanor and the dress of the salespeople. I mean, these are all things that are studied very extensively by firms that are usually hired by brands or retailers to try to enhance the so-called atmospherics. Whether, you know, they are so astute at rearranging these artificial atmospherics so that we are, again, you know, helpless sheep, you know, I seriously question. I think if we stopped for a minute and listened to the music playing, say, at Abercrombie and Fitch, we would understand and pretty well guess at why that music was the way it was and who it was appealing to and what might have been the motive of the store for pumping it through the sound system to begin with.
I was amazed to read about you sitting down with Paco Underhill, who is this researcher and sort of marketing guru that a lot of people in the selling industry really listen to. He told you the brand war is over and private labels have won.
Yeah, Paco Underhill is a very, very interesting guy. He's generally referred to as a retail anthropologist, and you know, without necessarily the academic credential. But for about 30 years, he's been running a company called EnviroCell. And for the most part, what that company does is to do what we were talking about a moment ago, which is to observe us, you know, almost as if we were animals in a zoo, and watch very carefully how we, you know, physically move through a store, you know, what makes us stop, what escapes our attention, and so on. And he's been tracking consumer behavior, you know, as I said, for about three decades. And what he said, and I agree with this, is that we've entered a time, and it's not just because of the recession at all. We entered this several years ago, and it's going to be a pretty long time, in which the power or the magic of the big name brands, you know, the big name designers, Ralph Lauren or, you know, any of the big brands, even Tide detergent, the power of those brands has become much lessened in the last few years, and will likely continue to be. And his reason is that, you know, we've entered what he would call the age of cheap. That, you know, prices, leaving aside the state of the economy right now, prices have been plateauing or even going down in real terms for a good long while now. And what we're, thanks to globalization and all the other things that we talk about, which also has a negative effect on our economy, but leave that aside for the moment, and that we are more and more becoming very accepting of, even preferring, generic products or private label products. And when you say private label, I don't just mean, you know, you walk into your drugstore and there's the drugstore's label on a bottle of aspirin. There are enormous chain stores now, you know, H&M, for example, or Zara, or so on and so forth, that are effectively private label stores. You know, you don't, except for the occasional guest appearance by, you know, Jimmy Choo at H&M or something like that. These are basically monuments to a single label, and that's really pushing. And if you go to, you know, a big box discounter, you're going to see all kinds of generic or private label alternatives to Crest toothpaste or Tide laundry detergent. And we've gotten over this feeling that we had, you know, some years ago, that somehow there was something inferior about a bottle of something, a jar of something, that didn't have a widely advertised label on it. We've gotten over that, and we accept the fact that there are a great many products, if not most products, that you can find really, you know, perfectly fine substitutes, alternatives for, that are cheaper. And the reason they're cheaper is because in the pricing equation, the store has removed the cut that Ralph Lauren used to get. You know, there's no big name label middleman or woman, and therefore the level of profit that the brand used to extract has been removed from the price.
Lee Eisenberg is with us. His new book is called Shoptimism: Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lee Eisenberg, former editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine and executive vice president of Land's End. His new book is called Shoptimism: Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk about this idea of sort of using what we buy to express ourselves. We've done shows on this topic in the past, and we often hear about from lots of people who call in and say, I never do that. But in fact, even those of us who think we're bucking the trend are consciously choosing, say, no label items or organic foods or whatever. So we're sort of all part of this.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. I think there's a mistaken assumption that if you choose, a so-called Regan lifestyle, you know, which is a life of voluntary simplicity, you're somehow not making consumer choices. You are making consumer choices. You're just not making mainstream consumer choices. And one of the themes that I try to develop in the book is that buying, while and none of this, by the way, let me do one disclaimer. None of this is to advocate reckless buying or impulsive buying. That's not what I'm about. And in fact, if anything, I sort of lean in the direction of an anti-consumerist. But the fact is, the choices that we make are self-expressive, whether we want to admit that or not. And in saying that, I actually think that's a underappreciated aspect of buying, that there is a certain creativity or self-expression that's involved in the choices we make, which often, as I think your question suggests, is not acknowledged by those who are, extremely anti-consumerist.
What makes it so hard to recognize?
Recognize that
everybody's part of this.
Well, I think if you go back, I think there's something embedded in the American character. If you turn back the clock 200 years, the prevailing consumption ethos, creed, was, waste not, want not. We were a very frugal society, and we were basically, adhering to the Protestant ethic that you saved your pennies and so on and so forth. And obviously that changed, and it began to change in the early 1900s when these enormously extravagant department stores started popping up. They looked like Italian palazzos. And goods from all over the world suddenly became available because of transportation, industrialization, and so on. So almost overnight, the American worker was faced with not scarcity anymore, but abundance. And at the same time, the American worker, working in factories for the most part, increasingly, had a weekly paycheck. So we had to somehow, you mentioned rewiring one's character, we had to kind of rewire the American character. And I think what we became is a people that still carry with us, sometimes buried quite deeply, a sense that it's important to be frugal and that it's important not to be reckless. But at the same time, we've developed a real passion for, or certainly a taste for, acquiring things. And, what I think is interesting about that conflict is that it's really coming, it's bubbling back to the surface now that we are living in tough economic times. I think for a long time we just sort of basked in the glow of acquiring things. And now we're beginning to appreciate maybe frugality is not such a bad thing, even though it can be very painful if you don't have a job. But the net of all that is, I think we're regaining a kind of equilibrium, which is very healthy. That we are going to be more mindful. We're going to be less mindless. But that's not to say, again, that we're going to flop over to one extreme and not indulge once in a while. But I think the bottom line is that, for all the wrong reasons, which is, a lot of economic hardship today, we're at least regaining a sense of balance about, how and where and when to buy things.
What plays into our definitions of what we need as compared with what we want?
Well, that's the $64, or I guess today reduced to $54 question. And that occupies a fair part of the book, which is what is the difference between something I think I need versus something that I really want? And, you know, if you want to be literal about it, we don't need all that much. You know, we need food, and we need clothing, and we need shelter, and I guess we need health care. But that's it. I mean, we don't have to buy a whole lot more than that. So everything else, in a literal sense, by definition, is a want. But, you know, that said, there are just a ton of things that we just really want that we really do need at a certain level. You know, it's very hard to live without a computer these days. More and more people need a microwave oven. You know, we need a refrigerator. You know, we just need a lot of things. And then when you keep going up the ladder of questionable, perhaps questionable needs, it can still get kind of dicey. You know, in the book, there's the famous psychologist Abraham Maslow, who's best known for his hierarchy of needs. Yet he has this famous pyramid that appears in, you know, most psychology or sociology books.
Yeah,
it
ends with self-actualization at the very
end. Yeah, and, you know, it starts with, you know, basic stuff, which is the stuff we need to subsist, but then you get into the need for love, the need for a sort of emotional connection, the need for community, and ultimately the need, as you say, for self-actualization. And, you know, I can go through each of those needs and give you a, you know, in effect, a material good that can address that need. You know, I at one point I read about somebody I know who's this fanatic railroad train buff, and his wife accuses him of being way out of control, you know, a shopaholic when it comes to, model railroading stuff. But, you know, I could make a plausible argument for how that, you know, his train board satisfies a great many needs that he has for self-expression, for, you know, he has kids in from the neighborhood, and he gets a lot of satisfaction letting them run the trains. Occasionally he goes off to these weekend, you know, train meets or where other buffs go, and he's got a strong sense of community. And even in terms of self-actualization, he really feels he's come into his own, or he comes into his own when he figures out, you know, some tricky thing to do with a plastic semaphore, or he figures out a better way to put, you know, fake snow on the mountains. I mean, he gets enormous gratification out of that. So, you know, on the one hand, does he need that model train set? You know, no, not to survive. Does it add something pretty important to his life? Yes.
Lee Eisenberg is my guest. His new book is called Shoptimism: Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first to Chris in Dallas. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Lee. I've got a question for you. What do you think is happening at the board level and in these boardrooms at these giant multi-hundred-billion-dollar companies, the likes of SC Johnson, Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, that have built their entire franchise around branded products? And sort of what do you think they're doing? What are their strategic maneuvers to deal with what seems to be this, material change in consumer behavior?
Yeah, it's a good question. What I think they're doing is worrying a lot. They are doing some fairly clever things. They're creating their own generics in some cases. They're creating, in effect, something that doesn't have, you know, the big, well-advertised brand name on it. They're creating it more cheaply, or they're taking smaller profits out of it and trying to compete with those who are competing with them. The other thing they're doing, and we haven't gotten into this yet, but it's really important, is they're paying a huge amount of attention to what people like you and I are saying about their products online through social media or product reviews, which virtually every e-commerce site has, trying to sort of, as closely as they can, monitor how we're feeling about their brands and then taking whatever action they can. And then in turn, you know, using social media, I mean, I think there are very few big brands anymore that aren't trying to figure out how they could insinuate our conversations, you know, through Facebook or Twitter or product reviews or so on. And I think they're very wise to be paying attention to that, but I don't think they've quite figured out how they might turn that to their own advantage yet.
It really is interesting the amount of influence that those little reviews tend to have of particular products. People do listen to one another with less skepticism than they listen to an ad.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, study after study confirms that. You know, 85% of us say we would rather hear what people like us think about something as opposed to what, you know, that something's advertising agency says about it. That is a major change, and that's actually a very positive change because, you know, the power, if you will, has been shifted away from these allegedly manipulating and exploiting marketing forces, and really rests more with us right now. And I don't think that's going to change. What a lot of companies need to understand, though, is that if they're going to open up the floodgates, and they should, because customers now expect it, if they're going to have honest and unfiltered user-generated reviews of their products online, they're going to have to live with bad reviews as well as good reviews. And that is an extraordinarily difficult culture change for them to make. But a lot of companies have made it, and you know, Amazon.com, for example, was one of the first to, you know, just post your reviews of books, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. And PetSmart does it, and virtually everybody does it now. And it's almost become a competitive handicap not to have honest and unfiltered reviews because, you know, we're becoming programmed voluntarily to seek out some honest opinion, or at least uncensored opinion about a product or a store.
It would seem like a great resource for buyers of merchandise who are going to put it out there at the retail level in terms of predicting demand for things and sort of taking orders for the next year's or the next season's products.
Yeah, and it absolutely is, and it is used very widely that way. It's very inexpensive, and I think for the most part, methodologically pure testing. It's not rigged. There's not a third party testing organization in there that may or may not be asking the right questions of the consumer, and it's pretty transparent. You don't need a whole lot of analysts analyzing it. Although there's now a growing industry really of companies, and I spend time with one of them in particular, that do nothing but monitor what we are saying about, you know, a given store or a given product. They trawl the web and bring back not just the specific comments, but the emotional intensity that we express through our comments. And they have these things called, you know, emotion meters. You know, they have all these fancy graphs and stuff. And they actually make graphs out of, you know, what we are talking about, but as importantly, how passionate are we? You know, if we dislike a store, how much do we dislike a store? And what they purport to do, and, you know, you can argue back and forth as to whether they're really doing it accurately and whether some of this is just, you know, a little bit too glib to be true, but they can measure the intensity of our feeling about, you know, a store or whether a product is delivering on its promise. And virtually every large company now, the marketing department employs either in-house or one of these third-party listeners, you know, people listening to the internet through the wall with a glass pressed to their ear, to try to measure what broad consumer sentiment is saying about their particular product.
Well, and what's so interesting about that, Lee, is that whether we buy very little or a lot relative to other people in our peer group, a lot of us are, in fact, passionate about the things that we ultimately do spend our money on.
We're not only, yes, and we can, you know, literally make or break a brand. I mean, one case that I talk about quite a bit in the book is the Starbucks brand, which went from being, you know, this very clear, appealing, attractive, innovative, sort of community-based, tribal-based brand into one that began to create quite a lot of disaffection among the people who made the brand successful. In the name of very rapid expansion and growth, Starbucks began to break the very promises that it was founded on in many instances. And that, in turn, disaffected a number of so-called, you know, brand tribal members. And those people began through word of mouth, you know, dissing Starbucks. And then suddenly Starbucks woke up one day a lot bigger than it had ever been. But suddenly there was a real pushback. You know, it's turning into McDonald's. You know, it's cookie cutter. There's too many of them. You know, it's lost that intimacy that it had. And you know, it's a classic example of how a brand can uncool itself, perhaps not by not listening more attentively to what its community members were saying about it.
Lee Eisenberg is my guest. His new book is called Shoptimism. We'll go back to the phones now and speak this time with John, in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I was curious if your guest had addressed the idea, the topic of peak oil anywhere in his book, which has gotten a bit of press lately with the independent film Collapse, directed by Chris Smith, that just came out, and how it links to driving consumers, and especially probably in general all around the world, towards things that are local versus global. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
I missed the reference. Had I heard or dealt with what specifically?
The idea of peak oil affecting the way people are shopping and people going to looking to purchase more local products as opposed to those that are produced globally, and whether that's really affecting the way people approach their shopping tasks.
Yeah, well, it's definitely part of the zeitgeist now. You know, I don't know that it's, you know, going to reach some kind of critical mass, but you know, we go through these cultural infatuations, some of which deserve to stick and grow, and some of them, you know, turn out to be evanescent and just go away. A couple of years ago, when I was researching the book, the hot topic at a lot of these sell-side conferences was something called gravanity, which was a contraction of graffiti and vanity. And it referred to our ability to put our name or our family's picture or our dog's photograph on a product or the side of our car, basically to personalize things. And, you know, I could not go to a conference without hearing people go on and on about gravanity. And today, we just ain't talking about gravanity. We've got many, many more serious things on our plate.
It's not. It doesn't have enough gravity, I guess.
That's true.
Lee Eisenberg is my guest. His new book is called Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You can get to us via email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lee Eisenberg. He is former editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine and a former executive vice president for Land's End. His new book is called Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Lee, I want to talk about the greatest bit of gonzo journalism that you did for this book. You went and worked at a Target store for like a month.
Mm-hmm. So last year at this time during the holiday selling season.
Talk about how you got the job.
It's not a pretty story. the truth is I was driving my son to take his SAT test on a Saturday morning, and I'd been thinking that it would be good to get some retail experience. So I got in the car. I was unshaven. I was virtually wearing my pajamas. I was wearing a dirty T-shirt and shorts and so on. And I dropped them off. And I knew that to apply for a job at Target, you actually do it in the store. There are kiosks in the front of the store, which you probably noticed. And you basically sit down and fill out an online application. And I did, and it was fairly lengthy. It took about 15 or 6, you know, 20 minutes, and asked me about my past history, my employment history, and then a series of sort of psychologically appropriate to work at Target, which I filled out. And then at the end, I pressed submit, and I thought the application would go right to a HR person in Minneapolis, which is where Target is headquartered. But instead, a screen came up and told me to pick up the red phone to the right of the computer monitor. And I picked that up thinking, you know, I'd get a recorded message from the CEO saying, you know, thank you for your interest in Target and have a nice day. But instead, there was a live voice on the other end. It was the assistant manager who was about 100 yards away from me in the back office. And those 100 yards were the longest 100 yards I've ever walked in my life because, I mean, I look like a not a very solid citizen at all.
You were not dressed for success as in the way that Esquire magazine might recommend.
or any other. And, you know, I'm old enough to be the grandfather of everybody else working at Target there. So I didn't know what to say, but what I did say was the truth, which was, you know, I do want to work at Target over the holiday season. I didn't want to work at that Target because I wanted to work at I live in Chicago, and I wanted to work at a really huge new Target in a very diverse neighborhood. And I managed to get that out of my mouth, saying, look, I really apologize, but I'd rather work at the other one. And she very cheerfully said that she'd send my resume over, and, you know, sure enough, I made the cut. So I worked there, and the most interesting part of it was the orientation. It proved to be very helpful in terms of how I saw how a very large retail chain tried to sort of keep everything together.
Yeah, you essentially say that they, although they have sort of really good, responsible policies in terms of sexual harassment and making sure that customers are treated in ways that are appropriate if they happen to be disabled or something, but they're not teaching their employees anything about the products that they're there to ring up at the register.
No, absolutely not. And nor do they presume to, nor do they hold out the promise that they do. They can't. There are too many things in the store. You know, they can't teach you why one crock pot out-crocks another crock pot. Let alone the, you know, tens of thousands of other items that are in the store. It's just way too big. So what you're trained to do is to basically say the following six words. I think it's six words and nothing else, which is, may I help you find something? So you're really a sort of a human GPS system unto yourself.
Pointing to aisle nine.
Right. Or if you've got the time, sort of walk somebody halfway over there. And then the rest of the time, you know, you've got more than enough to do, you know, walking around, as I learned how to do, walking around with a barcode reader, you know, in a holster. I felt, you know, as much of a heroic cowboy as I've ever felt in my life, scanning, you know, jugs of Clorox and other things. And then a huge amount of my time was spent putting back in the right place all of the items that so many of us take out of the right place, put in our carts, and then put them back in the wrong place. That made a lot of work for me, and it may employ, I don't know what percentage of the people at Target, simply putting everything back, you know, where it belongs.
Target is always nice and tidy, though, I have to say.
Well, you can thank me and my several hundred million, not colleagues, associates, team members. My team members for that.
So what does all that mean to us as consumers? Because I shop at Target all the time, but it's not my expectation that anyone can help me figure out which crock pot is better than the
right.
other.
Right, and that's part of the reason that the prices are good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's also something we need to accept. You know, there's going to be a trade-off. If we want a big box discounter to basically give us things that are in real dollar terms are a lot cheaper than they used to be, then we're going to have to give something up. And, you know, that gets to be a very, very serious and important issue because, yes, we want the prices that Walmart gives us, but then, you know, we sort of turn around and say, but we also want everything made here
mm-hmm.
in the U.S., and we also want customer service. We want people who know what they're talking about when we walk in to buy, you know, a DVD player, and why do I need these buttons? Do I need this feature? You know, and so on and so forth. So, you know, in a perfect world, you'd have cheap prices and incredible customer service and 4% unemployment in the U.S., but unfortunately, those things don't necessarily correlate.
The one interesting thing, though, that comes up here, too, is that nobody seems to struggle anymore, most people, with the fact that it might be déclassé to shop at Target. The stigma of shopping at a big box place has all but fallen away for
a lot of
American
consumers.
Well,
not only fallen away, I mean, it's actually cool. I mean, Target, you know, notoriously Target effect, actually, you know, had gotten to be cool. I actually think it's a little less cool now, not because it's a big box discounter, but I don't know, we're just not in the mood to be amused by, you know, Michael Graves teapots the way
right.
we were several years ago. Times are too tough for that. But even more, I think, than that is I was on the radio a couple weeks ago, and I got a call from a woman who told me that she had always shopped thrift shops for her clothing, and she just likes that. She likes vintage clothing. And she was getting increasingly stressed because there are so many people now shopping thrift shops, not just people who need to shop them because, you know, because of their income or lack of it, but a lot of people with quite a lot of money are now shopping thrift shops, and she was complaining that they're all driving the prices up at the thrift shop, which I feel some compassion for. So it's and then on the other hand, I run into people all the time who have gotten through this meltdown relatively unscathed, or even have a lot of money. And I can't tell you the number of women, for example, who've said, you know, I just can't believe what I used to spend for a pair of shoes. And these are women who can still afford those ridiculously expensive, you know, Manolo Blahniks or whatever they might be shoes, but they just don't feel comfortable wearing them. And not because people will point to them and say, oh, you know, you're sort of rubbing it in our faces. Something has changed in the general mindset that people just don't allow for the rightness of way overpaying for something like a pair of shoes. So, you know, we're in a very curious and sensitive and probably pivotal moment right now in terms of consumption.
So give us some insight into your title then. Why call the book Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What?
Well, the second part of that, why the American consumer will keep on buying no matter what, I mean quite literally, which is we're going to keep on buying. The question is, how are we going to buy? What are we going to buy? Where are we going to buy? How much are we going to spend? We're going to, you know, where there's a will to shop and a need to shop, and there's both a need and a will to shop, we will find a way to shop. The question is, will it be different from the way we were accustomed to? The Shoptimism part is not some kind of, you know, coded way of saying everything is going to be great again and that, you know, we need to go back to our mindless ways. It's that there are some components of consumption that actually are very fulfilling and meaningful and profound. You know, many, many studies point, for example, to the great satisfaction one gets in buying experiences, you know, a family vacation, taking pictures on that family vacation. Study after study will tell us that the memories that we maintain about a shared experience not only endure, but they tend to get more positive over time. We remember trips that we took, for example, more fondly, even if we didn't have such a great time at the time. we remember them more fondly. I also think that buying, there are many superficial things that we spend money on that you can easily say, that's just ridiculous and stupid and silly. But that enable us in a variety of ways, some of them very small and superficial, that can transform us. You know, if you don't want to be gray-haired and you want to be blonde or dark-haired and you go in and buy hair dye and just, you know, or get it done at the beauty salon or whatever, I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think that's a crime, assuming you can afford it, and most people can afford that. And that in itself is a form of self-expression. And then, of course, there's buying for other people. There's gift giving, which obviously is relevant to the moment. We may not have been very thoughtful about our gift giving over the last several years. I think we gave a lot of things recklessly and impulsively and didn't think about it. But the fact is, a well-conceived, well-thought-through gift, especially if it comes at a time other than the holidays or birthday or anniversary, can be a very meaningful, you know, expression of affection and a very meaningful expression of I know who you are, and this is a delightful thing for me to be able to give you and to receive. So at the end of the book, in the title chapter, Shoptimism, I try to go through a number of ways, some of them minor, some of them, I think, a little more profound, that tries not to make everything we buy, you know, justifiable, but at least results in a book that I think is sort of an anti-consumption book as opposed to a pro-consumption book, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I think we have time for one more call, and we will take that from Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just had a quick comment. I've only been listening about the last 10 or 15 minutes. I do agree with you regarding that, you know, some consumption, it's not all consumption is all bad or consumption is all good. I think those are kind of extremist points of view. But, I'm concerned about the American population, American public, simply because I feel like we've been indoctrinated to the idea that material goods can really meet an emotional need. And you look at commercials for jewelry or alcohol or things that really kind of play to that, you know, you're going to be a great person because you drink this or buy this or use this. And I think that we've all bought into that. And so even though we've had this big downturn and people are really starting to kind of check their spending and, you know, maybe they're not going to buy that expensive pair of shoes, but my concern is that the hit really hasn't been hard enough for people to really change the way they think about themselves and their own self-worth, so that in a year or two when things pick up, I think people will go right back to spending on things that they probably don't need, that are beyond their means, and I think we'll just continue in the same cycle until we change how we understand who we are and where we derive our self-worth from.
What do you think about
that? My response off the air.
I don't disagree with that at all. I guess the only thing I would quarrel with is the indoctrinated part, you know, that somehow other forces made us do that. You know, you can go back to virtually any culture, almost at any point in history, and you could, you know, in most of them see signs of what, you know, Thorsten Veblen in 1900 called conspicuous consumption. You know, there may be something built into us that makes us want to aspire to something presumably, arguably, greater or prettier or richer looking or whatever it might be than we really are. So while I don't at all disagree with, you know, your diagnosis, what I do disagree with a little bit is that there's some unseen force, the diabolical force, that's making us do that. And having said that, I will tell you that we are living in a world with way too much advertising, you know, way too much marketing, way too much product placement, way too much all of those things. But I think we have to hold both thoughts in our mind simultaneously. There's just way too much marketing in our culture. It's too materialistic. But at the same time, I do think there's something in us that wants to, you know, beautify ourselves or rise up even in our own self-perception socioeconomically.
Lee Eisenberg is former editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine and former executive vice president for Land's End. His new book is called Shoptimism: Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. Lee, it's been a really fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
It's been fun, Chris. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.